Hey, everybody. I'm Lisa Burwell, your host of V Speaks, Conversations with Heart and Soul. This is episode 98. We are approaching 100 in a couple of episodes, and it's very fitting for me to be able to sit with my guest, Dr. David Weil. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So you're an author of 3 books. I had the great privilege of reading your book yesterday, Exhale, which was your first book. How long did it take you to write the book?
3 years.
Wow. 3 years.
Yeah, I drafted it in 6 months. I had a lot on my mind.
Okay.
And then 2.5 years of editing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that a labor of love? Was it something that you just had to see realize? Like, what gave you the juice to keep going?
Yeah, it was cathartic in a lot of ways. I was pretty sure walking around the hospital doing my job that I was going to write about it one day. And in fact, started taking courses at Stanford at night in memoir writing, thinking that I was going to write about all this one day, because I was the kind of person that walked around the hospital a lot of times alone at night and saw things. And I always turned to an imaginary friend and said, I wish somebody else could see this. And
really?
That was my motivation to write the book.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned to you before we started rolling, I was captivated by your book. And I honestly wasn't expecting to be that captivated by it because, you know, it's your world as your life trajectory and your career and something like very few people get to be in. Director of the Heart and Lung Transplant at Stanford. Is that the right title?
Yes.
And, you know, it's a small society. It's a small group of people that are that skilled and specialized on doing something that maybe even 20 years wasn't as commonplace as it is right now, and that the technology has come fairly far since then. And how was that? Like, what led you down the road to basically doing your life's passion?
It was a dream come true. I mean, it was a privilege. And like a lot of things that happened to us, it happened accidentally. I was an intern 2 weeks out of medical school, and somebody got sick on the kidney transplant service during my internship, and they asked for a volunteer just to help do the menial tasks. Mm-hmm. And I raised my hand. And I got on the kidney transplant service, and the first night we do a kidney transplant, I was in charge of watching the patient make sure they urinated. That was my main job all night long.
Oh.
And I saw that happen, and I saw that night how this operation could change people's lives, and it changed mine in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. And you somewhat followed in the footsteps of your father, which is also like a very lovely pass the torch, you know, keep it going through the generations as well. And in your book, you say he was like kind of stoic, kind of stern and all that, but he was really proud of you as well.
I think so. He was German in every way.
Okay.
And I think German folks are not known to emote. And he didn't tell me how proud he was of me. We didn't share emotions like that in my family.
But you knew, like as the reader of the book, like you could, the subtleties of what he did or did not say really did emote.
That's right.
That's
right.
He was quite proud of you.
Yeah, I think so. And every now and then I would overhear a conversation he was having with somebody else about me. So I had some notion that he was proud of me.
Right. So your mom was a nurse.
Yep.
And your dad was a doctor. So you really felt followed through. Now, do you think either of your daughters have a propensity or proclivity to go into the medical profession?
No, they ran as far away from it as they could. And one is in communications in New York, and one is studying to be a journalist.
Oh.
At TCU.
Well, still, like, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, because you're a writer.
Right.
And a very good one, I might add, because your book was riveting. And I really wanted to. It's not like, oh, I've got to get through this. It's like, wait a minute. I don't have the answer to what you just said. Did I miss something for, like, you know, in chapter 5? And then, like, in chapter 6, you know, you'll address, like, what happened to, like, either a patient. You know, because this is not a TV show. This is real life, heart and soul, people giving people the ability to continue living with new lungs and a new heart. This is not, this is a serious matter and something that was clearly very intimate for you with your patients and your their families. And it, throughout the book, I mean, you could tell like how much you loved them, how much you cared about them, and that you were just not clocking in a job or like building a resume. You could tell that you were not doing it, although you were building a resume and, you know, you're very well known for what you do. But this is what you were meant to do. And then can you tell me some of the stories that are in the book or tell the listeners some of the people you lost and so many that you were able to save?
Yeah, I think the most meaningful interactions I had in the hospital, and to your point, this was a mission for me. This was religion before I had any.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the patients that affected me most were the young ones.
Yeah.
And the reason is I saw my daughters in some of the young women that I transplanted. And I also saw people that didn't have a childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their childhood was taken from them by disease,
mm-hmm.
by being unable to do the most simple things that you and I take for granted, my kids take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we were able to return young men and women to their life, and I was able to run a 5K with somebody that had never walked more than 500 feet, and when I was able to go to the marriage of a young lady that we transplanted, then get cards and letters still about the kids that she's mothering, you can't replace that with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm not doing it anymore, I've tried, mm-hmm. but you can't replace that.
Mm-hmm.
Those are magical feelings because you develop a bond not only with the patient, but their family.
Mm-hmm.
They all become part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And the gratitude that they showed to me was great, but what I got from them was education of a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. So many success stories, and I even found myself, and my husband, it was an audio book, so he was like overhearing something, and like at one point, when one of your patients that you really liked a lot, who was getting a second lung transplant, and was young too, and you could tell you two were totally simpatico and had a great relationship,
I know
and
you're talking
which he was
about.
Your favorite,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then when you, when you were narrating your own book too, which I want to ask about that in a minute, but that was really poignant as well because that wasn't an actor who was like emoting that like you were really sad by that. It was you. And that was pretty powerful. We'll talk about that in a minute about how that happened, which I think was really good. But then we like kind of gasped like, no, she didn't make it. And so maybe you dedicated like a chapter or 4 or 5 pages to it. But for me as the reader, listening to that story that you so beautifully were able to tell, it like really was so sad. And I'm like beyond 6 degrees of separation from what you were. And then you had so many success stories. Think if you like, where were you? I think you were in Denver working where you did 100 transplants and all of them lived. Okay. And that was like in your first 5 years of your career, right?
Yeah, that was early.
And you speak about like how much you loved it and how happy you were. And of course, you would be happy and it would be an adrenaline rush because it was success.
Right.
So, do you think if you had been able to continue that and you wouldn't have to say goodbye to some of the people that you had to say goodbye to, do you think you'd still be doing it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Unequivocally, yes. I mean, I think I kind of looked at my whole career in terms of the losses we had. You start out with a piece of paper. And when you lose a patient, you tear off one piece and drop it. And then you tear off another and drop it, and you tear off another, and then suddenly there's nothing there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of us have a capacity for empathy and compassion, but it's not limitless. And I think what happened is I write in the book, when I decided it was time for me to go, I had run out. Mm-hmm. And I could not watch that happen again. Mm-hmm. I felt personally responsible mm-hmm. for it. Mm-hmm. I felt grief. And I couldn't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. The saves were great, but they were no match for the people that we lost, you know. And I think that I recognized it was painful, but I recognized it was time for me mm-hmm. to walk out.
Well, you say in the book, like, I think you say, I'm done. I'm just done.
Yeah.
And like, I think we all know, without any song and dance or a long explanation to ourselves about like what's going to happen, when you say I'm done, you're pretty done.
Yeah. I was done. And most people, when they say they're done, they were done a while ago.
Exactly. Exactly. Just like the 10th I'm done.
That's right.
Or the 100th.
That's right. And then, right.
Yeah.
And I think the last couple of years I was at Stanford, I was done.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to admit to yourself that you're done, especially about a career that I care a lot about.
Right.
I had a family at home and all those sorts of things.
Yeah. And you built or rebuilt the Stanford medical program, right? Because they were fledgling.
Yeah, it was kind of an old house that needed renovation.
Right. And so you built that from the ground up. It was very, very successful. And you made your mark, for sure, in your career. Everyone knows like how great that endeavor was that you did. And then various things happened. Personally, you couldn't do it anymore. But also, I think in the book, I started seeing like the handwriting on the wall when like some of your doctors were leaving, and you brought them up, and you trained them, and then me being a business owner, very, very different. I'm not aligning myself with the unbelievable work that you do, but it's my mission field, what I do, just like yours is.
Yeah.
And then when you build teams, and you know things are cooking along, and then you have some people like leaving, it is not the easiest curveball to catch,
right?
And it's a lot of work to like, I wouldn't say rebuild it, because you do have an infrastructure, but you know what's ahead of you when you have to be the coach or you're helming something with new team members, right?
I think that's right. I mean, transplant in particular in medicine is a team sport.
Yeah.
And there were 60 people on our team. And as you mentioned, some of the key ones left for a variety of reasons, retirement, big job, et cetera. And I think what happens is there's so many moving parts anyway in my field that those key members left. And I knew, the worst part about it is I knew we weren't as good as we were.
Yeah.
And
that's hard.
And I was the face of the program to a patient group who didn't really care who came and who went. They just wanted to survive. Yet I knew that we weren't performing at our best. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the most difficult part for me. And sometimes I didn't, behave beautifully in that situation. And I write about that honestly in the book. But that's where the frustration came.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the other thing about you're so transparent, you're so honest in your own self evaluation, and then the evaluation of others too. Mm. It's a very raw and very real, which of course would resonate with anybody, because do you know there's very little authenticity left in the world?
Oh, God.
It's like very hard to
thank you, social media.
Is that what the problem is?
I think so, because everybody wants to portray themselves as perfect in social media, whether it's a picture or a vacation or I had the perfect meal.
Yeah.
Maybe there's other factors, but that's not helping.
Yeah. No, so it was like really refreshing.
Yeah.
And then how long did it take you to write the book? I know I've already asked you this preview.
6 months of drafting, 2.5 years of editing, and then another 6 months until it got on the shelf.
So then when the book was on the shelf, was it everything that you wanted? Was it perfect? Did you say, oh, I wish I had put this in or taken something out? Were you okay with it?
Well, so it got published, and I'll never forget the date, May 11th, 2021. And I remember waking up that morning and said, my God, what have I done?
I know the feeling.
And, you know, because as you point out, it's very revealing. Mm-hmm. It is raw. Mm-hmm. I didn't hold anything back. And now everybody was going to read it. And that's frightening.
It is.
But I soon realized that people were understanding where I was coming from better than I thought they would. And they started to relate to the book, and they started to see themselves mm-hmm. in parts of the book. Mm-hmm. And that's really what you want. Mm-hmm. If it's a story about me, then I think the interest would be fairly limited. But if people start to see themselves in the book and they can understand what you were going through, then that's great. Especially, I think, the people that knew me, but they didn't know this part of me.
Right.
And that was a big group of people.
Did you get any flack from anybody that you said something about in the book that you worked with?
Yeah, I worried about that. And I probably did, but none directly. So I assume that...
You're Teflon.
Yeah. Well, I assume there might have been some chatter that I wasn't privy to, but
that's good.
I haven't really heard anything
like that. I mean,
it wasn't
bad. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
They probably knew who they were.
Probably.
And whatnot.
Yeah, probably.
When we first met for lunch a month and a half ago, you told me a story about a gentleman who you gave a lung transplant to, who found out that the lungs were from an African American.
Yeah.
Can you recount that story again for the listeners?
Yeah, you know, transplant's interesting in that you meet all kinds of people. Some you like a lot, some you don't like as much. It's a human thing. Mm-hmm. And there is a gentleman, and I should say that all human behavior is exposed during the course of doing this work. People are at their most vulnerable period. So we transplanted a person, a white man, middle-aged man, who, and this happened some of the time, they wanted to find out more about their donor. And there were various ways to do that. You get connected with the donor family, both have to say it's okay to be connected, and then you suddenly start putting pieces together about who the donor was. So this gentleman came to understand that his donor was a black man, and when he found that out, he asked to meet with me, and I did. And he went on to tell me how disappointed he was, and he didn't use the word disappointed. Mm-hmm. And he told me that had he known that the donor lung that saved his life came from a black family, he would have turned it down. So pretty eye-opening behavior, and it makes you realize, now, I grew up in the South. Did I understand that this kind of attitude existed? I did. Mm-hmm. But to hear it put so starkly in a guy that just had his life saved, mm-hmm. that was new to me.
Mm-hmm.
That was new to me.
That was a new level.
It was. And the challenge was for our team, who became aware of this man's attitude, was to take care of him just like we take care of everybody else, with the same passion and diligence. And that's not easy.
Yeah.
You're taking care of people that you don't like that much.
Right, right. But weren't you successful in fostering like sort of a turn of events, which is like the really good ending of the story?
Yeah. I think... If, again, if you could just talk to people and you can get people to talk to each other, which we did with this gentleman, mm-hmm. talk to this donor family, meet them, understand them as human beings, understand what they gave to you and what they sacrificed to give to you. Mm-hmm. He actually did a complete 360 or 180, whichever, however it works.
One of them.
And kind of dropped that attitude. He got educated. He was ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
And his ignorance went away after meeting this donor family.
That's great.
And it wasn't just one meeting. It was a series of meetings. Mm-hmm. And that was gratifying.
Yeah. I mean, well, the fact that you went the extra mile, because I'm sure you had a lot of other people in queue that you needed to save their lives to, and that you go back to the gentleman that now has been saved with two pair of lungs, and you're taking the time to foster, let's call it a reconciliation, is a credit to you. Not many people would take the time.
Well, you know, those of us in transplant feel very strongly. We have our patient, but we also have donor families. And you can't do what we do without the donor families. Right. And so we feel like we need to take care of the donor families in the same way. Right. And I think, and I've seen this before, a lack of appreciation for the donor is something that really stuck in my craw. Mm. And whenever I saw that, I tried to rectify it as best I could.
Right.
And this was an extreme example of that.
Yeah.
But it was an example.
Yeah. Good for you. What was your, if there can be one, like your most rewarding success story, and then on the other side of it, the most heartbreaking?
I think the most rewarding success that I had is a young lady who I got an email from a few days ago. Who's now 17 years post-transplant. We transplanted at Stanford, went to her wedding, saw pictures and got birth announcements of her two kids. See the kind of hiking, biking, skiing that she does. And after 17 years, she writes me every day on her anniversary of her transplant.
Wow.
Every anniversary, I should say. She hasn't lost one iota of the wonder and gratitude. And to me, that makes it all worthwhile.
Yes.
So I think of all the patients I look back on, that was my the one I feel great about, and I hope I can have that for many more years with her. The toughest one is the one I wrote about in the book.
Girl.
Yeah, I called her Tina in the book.
Okay.
And Tina would have and should have been my daughter. She had a very similar attitude. She was the kind of person that I would walk into the clinic room and she'd have her feet up on the desk in the clinic room, and she'd actually be scrolling through the computer looking at her own laboratories, which violated about five or six different hospital policies. And she would use very salty language with me and very direct with me, and just was that wonderful person to be around. Great personality. And her mom is still in contact with me. But when her lungs started to fail after a number of years and we couldn't get her transplanted a second time, I was devastated. And she died right in front of me.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing, and I write about this in the book, that was really difficult. So I would leave that hospital setting. I would have to go home. I had two little daughters at the time. They're not so little anymore, but they were little then. I would have to, you know, switch into dad mode, husband mode, and try to do the best I could, you know, to have a family life. And I think sometimes I did that okay, and sometimes I did.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to compartmentalize, but I'm sure you had to become somewhat of a master of that.
Yeah, I tried.
Which is really hard to do.
Yeah.
Because eventually it's going to come up. I mean, it might not come up that day or that year, but 2 years later or something out of nowhere, you know, it's going to come up.
I think so. And, you know, we spent a lot of time, and this goes for the whole team, not just me, but we would have that happen in one room, and then a guy that did great with the transplant in the next room, and we'd have to come in beaming, going, I can't believe how great it is. Thanks, Mr. Miller. This is great. Yeah. Everything looks super.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, you know, I'm devastated. Yeah.
So how long did Tina live with her first transplant?
8 years.
That's good.
Yeah, 8 years. And I would have loved for it to be a whole lot longer.
Yeah.
Eight years.
But you gave her 8 years. Yeah. God gave her 8 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, we never know, like, you know, and you even say in the book, and I say this a lot too, like, you never know when the ending is coming.
That's right.
I mean, people feel bad. Oh, you need a lung transplant. And that same person that could be feeling so bad for you, like they could get in a car accident the next day. So you have to like really get the memo that life is fleeting.
It is.
And you better give it everything you got.
Yeah. We were talking before we came on about my 90-year-old mother.
Yes.
Tells me, do everything now, enjoy it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and sounds like she's still enjoying life.
She
is.
She definitely is. But she ends almost every conversation with she says in that her Alabama accent.
She still has an Alabama accent does. Living in New Orleans?
She does.
Okay.
And she says, enjoy the hell out of it.
Yeah. Well, sounds like she's definitely living in New Orleans.
Yes, exactly. It's known for its salty language.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So was it a big transition when you left California and then went back to New Orleans? Like, did you love it? Or did you go, wow, this isn't the same weather that I had?
Well, I decided to keep our house in California just in case.
Escape.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I moved back in August, and my girls were, you know, August in New Orleans is no joke.
Yep, that's no joke.
And having grown up in Palo Alto, they were like,
what?
Are you kidding? Uh-huh. There was that. And then there was also, I was just starting my career as a consultant, and it wasn't terribly busy. And so I coached eighth grade basketball when I moved back, and that's really what I had going on. And
that's pretty great.
It would be Tuesday morning, and I should be on rounds, or I should be doing something,
yeah.
And I'm sitting there, you know, getting ready for basketball practice.
Well, you played basketball in high school.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. My stature doesn't really indicate that I would, but yeah.
Well, I bet you're a good player.
I was determined.
Yeah. And then just to give a little anecdote in the book, then several times when you have to, like, when you're troubled or when you really need to think, you would go into your office and you would.
Yeah. I still do. Yeah. I have a basketball.
Throw the basketball in the air and catch it. And then you'd think. Yeah.
I would. I still do it. I twirl it on my finger. When I'm writing, I do it a lot. Okay, I kind of pick it up. And
that's good.
It's a security blanket.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Your mom. I don't know if we want to segue here. Let's just talk a little bit more about this book because we have to get into your other two books too. And all that was part of this. You said maybe that might be your favorite book because it was your first, but then like you can't have a favorite child. You can't have a favorite book, right? Because they're kind of like your children, right?
That's right.
But it was the first, and it seemed like it was a long endeavor.
Yeah.
But you had good editors. I know that you talk about that.
Yep.
And then I watched your TED Talks, too, and you said that that was a process as well. So, like, people just don't, like, whip out a book or whip out a TED Talks because you told me that your TED Talks was a six-month sort of, like, training.
Yeah.
Operation?
Yeah, the TED process is really interesting. You know, it's 17 minutes and it notoriously has to be 17, not meaning 1630 or 1730. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You memorize it. Mm-hmm. There's no teleprompter. There's no nothing. There's nothing on the stage.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, and the content has to be very specific. The TED people are very, they're sticklers about not having hot button topics in there, politics, religion, whatever.
Okay.
So they actually review the content and have to approve it.
Mm.
And then you have to deliver it in such a way that, you know, you've memorized this talk and it has to be exactly on point. And you stand in this little red circle. And when I give talks in other settings, I'm all over the place. I'm walking around and I'm, you know, talking off the cuff, just like we're talking. Mm-hmm. But this wasn't that. So it was different.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting, though.
Yeah, it was fun.
You know, it was fun.
I would do it again for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And where was that? Did you have a big audience?
Yeah, it was 350 people in a college outside of Atlanta. And it was fun. The audience was great. It was interactive. Mm-hmm. And I loved having a live audience. Not only was it being filmed and put on the website, but it was a live audience.
Yeah, which is good.
It was great.
I think it's like way better to do that. So at the close of, near the close of the book, Exhale, you mentioned that you, after a couple of years, took a job in New Orleans at Oshner's.
Yeah.
And how long were you there?
Not long.
No.
Not long.
Because you went back as a physician.
I did. I tried to a couple different times. It wasn't quite out of my system. It may not still be out of my system entirely, but I tried early on to go back. I tried to say, okay, I'm going to go back, but I'm not going to go all the way. And I kind of tried to piecemeal it a little bit, and it didn't work at all. Okay. I can't do it that way.
Yeah.
And so
all in or nothing.
Or nothing. And so while I valued the opportunity to be able to even try to do that, it wasn't going to work for me.
Right. So you leave that and also your Stanford gig that you had for many years. And then you don't exactly know what you're going to do, but you're calm. You can tell you're calm about it. You can tell that you're not like fretting like what the next chapter is going to be, even though you don't know what it's going to be. And then you start while consulting.
Yeah.
And that is, if you could explain.
Yeah, basically we do all things transplant. So there's six of us. We help transplant programs that are underperforming, whether or not it's team dynamics, which is a lot in our field, clinical, administrative, infrastructure, financial. We do quite a bit of financial work with the programs. Mm-hmm. And we just go in and figure out what's going on with the program and try to fix it. And we hang around for either 2 days, 2 years, or like I was saying before, 7 years, mm-hmm. Going on 7 years with one client. Mm-hmm. And we've just started to get a couple of international clients as well. So we're starting to do that in UAE and in
London
as well, UK as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all that you did, every step that you took at Stanford and every single experience that you had is how you're good at doing the consulting job for other people. You know, you're imparting like all these words of wisdom and tips about how their own transplant departments can do better, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
so was there like a great satisfaction in that?
Yeah, there is. You know, you're helping teams that then go on to help patients. It's one step removed from the direct patient interaction, and I miss that. And I'm clear with the transplant teams when I talk to them that don't take that for granted. Cherish it. It does not last forever.
Yeah.
And I like helping. I like fixing broken programs. And I like helping, especially younger physicians, nurses, administrators, everybody, deal with whatever challenges they're facing. Because, you know, and I say this with all immodesty, there's nothing in transplant that I haven't seen or heard before. I mean, and so whatever situation they're dealing with, I can usually kind of help them through it. Mm-hmm. And I like especially the part where I can sit down with team members and say, yeah, I hear you. I know what you're going through. And why don't you think about X, Y, and Z? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the best part of the whole job.
So good. So I think this is a good segue then to bring in sort of your spirituality in your quest that you've been on that was brought on by you watching Katrina, the storm of the century, tear apart New Orleans.
Yeah.
And so take us back then, which is that, 15 years ago now?
20.
20?
Yeah.
Wow.
21, I think.
21, yeah. And you know that storm was deadheaded for...
I do. I was watching it closely from a distance. I wasn't living in New Orleans at the time, obviously, but I was watching it really closely, and it was such a big storm. It took up the whole Gulf, you know? And no one knew where it was going to go.
Yeah.
But it did have an impact on me. You know, for me, it was a TV event.
Yeah.
And for the people that live there, it was much more than a TV event. Mm. And I've talked to many of them. But it felt biblical to me, you know, the floodwaters and the despair and the mayhem. And I decided at that time, and I was always interested in religion and kind of watched it over the fence, but I decided I was going to start reading the Bible. And started doing that with one of those daily readers. And so got through it all in a year and then decided I was going to do it a second year and then decided I was going to do it a third year.
In like one, two, three, like in a row?
Yeah, I did it 3 years.
Okay, when's the last time? What was the third time?
It's been now, geez, I think I finished the last time in 2010. So okay. It's been a number of years. Yeah. It's probably time to go back.
Well, it stays with you.
Yeah, it does.
If you need it, you can recall it for sure when you need it. And what did that do, like when you read it? What new dimension of your life did that give you?
Yeah, I've been asked that before. This is going to be such an obvious cliche answer, but it's really the one I have.
Okay.
Every one of our struggles has been around for thousands of years, right? And in the Bible, all those struggles are written about, documented, and they're the exact same ones we have right now. And while I don't think anyone takes all of it literally, or at least probably shouldn't take all of it literally. The struggles that are there are the same ones we have now. And it's kind of reassuring to know that there's nothing new under the sun. You know, these are all the same. And I really enjoyed that part. And I enjoyed part of the New Testament that, you know, talked about things that I was interested in. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the best advice book there is, right? And, you know,
yeah,
and
I think so.
I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I think it's probably time to take another look. So.
Well, so talk about, you were raised Catholic, right?
No. I was raised without any religion at all.
Oh, without any. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so my dad, Holocaust survivor from Germany, my mother, Southern Baptist from Selma, Alabama, and both turned their back on their religion for different reasons.
Right.
One having to do with the civil rights movement, one having to do with the Holocaust. And they asked us, and my sisters and me, do you want religion in your life? When we were young, I think I was 9 or 10. Yeah. And I just said, no, thanks. Yeah. I'm good. Yeah. And that was it. Okay. And so I didn't have really an answer to the question, what religion are you?
Okay. But then you found something out.
Yeah, I did. Just over the last few years, when I was actually doing promotional work for Exhale, and I was getting involved with the Jewish Book Council, and I was like, well, I'm not really Jewish. I mean, I don't know why they would be interested in this book, but here we go.
Yeah.
And I just told my mother this, and she said, well, you know, I converted to Judaism right before I married your father, and I think she was 88 at the time, or 87, or something like that. And I said, well, that would have been a good thing to know before now. And so that became the genesis for why I wanted to write this last book. You know, it's like, gosh, well, what religion am I then? So that's how that all started.
And so you've been to Israel a couple times?
Yeah.
Yeah. And were trips there because you were continuing on a search for...
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you know, in some ways, and I write about this, I think, in the last book, I was comparison shopping a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I hate to be so crass about it, but
okay.
There you go.
I get it. I understand. Okay.
I was kind of looking at all of them, all the religions, with kind of fresh eyes. I mean, I felt like I was undifferentiated. I mean, I was none of the above. And I looked at all of it with fresh eyes. And not too many. I mean, some people have an opportunity to do that, but probably not too many. So I felt lucky. I felt like, okay, I'll take a look at all this.
Yeah. And where are you now?
I identify as Jewish now.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my mom having converted, by definition, I'm Jewish.
Yes.
And it's not just that, because there's plenty of things by definition I don't hear too. Right. But also understanding my heritage. I mean, I come from 650 years of German Jews, most of whom were rabbis. And it'd be kind of hard to say that, okay, well, that didn't matter. You know,
right,
it does
right.
matter.
Right. Weirdly, you were kind of fulfilling a rabbi hat at your job at Stanford, by the way.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
I mean.
I think you're right.
It can come in many different ways that you can do something like that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So talk about your second book.
All That Really Matters.
All That Really Matters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a novel based around a heart transplant surgeon who has issues. It's not me.
As we all do.
Yeah. And I felt like the reason I wanted to write it, and my publisher was actually pretty eager for me to write the third book next.
Okay.
And I said, well, I want to write this novel first. And my editor, who's a wonderful woman named Claire Wachtel, said, okay, fine, just do the novel. That's fine. I wanted to go a little bit further than I could go in the memoir Exhale and tell some of the stuff I really couldn't say because of sensitivities and so forth.
So you cloaked it in a novel?
I did.
Yeah.
And I thought I could go a little bit deeper into the world that I lived in. Mm-hmm. And I use this character, Joe Bosco, because brilliant but flawed. Uh-huh. And I think so many people that I worked with were brilliant but flawed.
Yeah.
And I think it was interesting to see his interactions, and he got himself kind of into trouble and out of trouble. And it's a love story in many ways, mm-hmm. not only his love for transplant, but his love for the female character in the book. Yeah. And I wanted to explore some of those things more deeply, and I mm-hmm. felt like I could do it in a novel.
Yeah.
And I'm writing a sequel to it now.
Oh, you are?
I am.
Okay.
I am.
All right. And so that will be your fourth book.
That'll be my fourth
book. All right. And then your third one was Tell Me I Belong, A Faith Journey.
Yep.
Which was kind of like about what we just talked
That's
about.
That's right.
Yeah.
Spiritual journey. Yeah.
Yeah. Four books in how many years? Eight?
Yeah.
8 years.
That's about right.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. It's not John Grisham pace, but it's...
it's not, well, there's very few John Grisham pace books. I mean, I think it's over 100, right? It's something crazy.
He was just at the New Orleans Book Festival, and I got a chance to meet him.
Oh, was he awesome? I love him.
Oh, he's incredible. And okay. I was like, how do you do it?
Yeah,
he just came. And he said, ass in chair.
Yeah. You know, he was a lawyer.
I know.
And then just started writing books. And well, that's why he's so good at sort of writing legal books,
right?
Or legal related books, crime and punishment and all that.
No, he's remarkably engaging as well.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Does he know you are an author?
I told him I was.
Okay.
And great. Michael Lewis, I went to high school with Michael Lewis, the author, mm-hmm. and he introduced us.
Ah.
Yeah.
So cool. You know, one of these books could be turned into a TV show or a movie, you know. Do you know that? Is that next?
We're talking about that. Yeah. Yeah. There's some discussions about that, either a TV series or embedding with the transplant team and doing a kind of a reality.
Like a docu series.
It would be kind of a docu series.
Yeah. Because I think it would be amazing.
Yeah. And I would love to let people look at the team. The patients are the stars.
Yeah.
But the team that does this kind of work is pretty interesting.
Oh, they're like superheroes. Oh, not all superheroes wear capes.
Right.
Right? That's
right.
What you, I mean,
yeah.
Like, oh, and then you would be the person that would decide who would get
yeah.
heart or a lung or who yeah. wouldn't. So tell me like how heady, wrong word really,
yeah.
but the responsibility of that, the weight of it.
So there were two sides of decision making, who got it? And which donor you would accept for that person. So donors come in all form or fashion. Some of them are really high quality organs, some are less quality. So you had to decide, I want that donor for this recipient. And so you would pick people from the waiting list, knowing full well that if you told them they weren't on the waiting list, they knew and you knew that they were going to die.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And so,
yeah.
That was heavy responsibility. Took it really seriously. The whole team took it really seriously.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest challenge, and we spoke about this a minute ago, was to not bring your own value judgments to them as a human being
mm-hmm.
and say, look, mm-hmm. if they can take care of this organ, they deserve to live. Mm-hmm. I may not like them. They may not be my kind of guy or gal, but our responsibility is, this isn't high school.
Yeah.
We don't have to hang out with them.
Right. You just have to keep them alive.
Yeah. And a lot of times you heard in the discussions, and this happened everywhere, and it still happens in my consulting practice. Mm-hmm. Well, he was rude to one of the nurses, or...
Wow, the judgment.
Yeah. You know, or the family member,
yeah.
you know, is not great, or he didn't shower that day and he really smelled, you know, or whatever.
Mm.
And... Or he got arrested 15 years ago for a marijuana charge or something.
Yeah.
And to take that noise and have to put it to the side, you have to put it to the side, was at times difficult, deciding who gets an organ. It's a precious resource, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then on the donor side, as you can tell from the books, you also know that if you don't pick the donor that night and you pass on it, that person on the waiting list has a better chance to die.
Mm.
So you have to be appropriately aggressive. And I was definitely aggressive on that side, taking organs for people, but you can't be foolish.
Right. Well, the responsibility is God. You know, it's God-like responsibility to be able to have someone live or die.
Yeah, it's weighty. I mean, I and it's not one of those things that you say is weighty in retrospect. I mean, I knew it at the time that I was making some tough decisions.
Mm-hmm. Early in your career, I think it was in Denver, in the book, you talk about how, like, in the middle of the night, you would have to actually, like, get in a plane or a car and go actually get is that how it works?
Yeah, it does. And I'm working with a company that I think is going to change all that.
Oh.
Because it puts an amazing amount of stress on 24/7, 365. Transplant teams need to be ready to fly all over the country and get organs. A company that I'm working with called Transmedics, I serve on their board, full disclosure, actually has set up a logistics device where the organs come to the transplant program. So instead of the transplant doctors, there aren't many of us, flying all over the place, the organs actually get delivered.
Yeah, I was so surprised that that was in the book saying, okay, you've got all this other responsibility, and then you're driving somewhere or you're hopping on a plane in the middle of the night to retrieve said organs.
Yeah,
it sounded like a movie.
It's the toughest part of the job because it's 2 a.m. You're getting people, they've worked all day, you're putting them on an airplane to fly somewhere, and 20% of the time they're going to come back empty-handed. Mm-hmm. The organs didn't work for some reason. Mm-hmm. And it just burns the team out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And so...
It's like you're...
Yeah, and I think a lot of people tend to think of these transplant programs as these big companies with a lot of people around. They're not. There's very few.
Yeah.
And... That's why I'm so enthusiastic about this company, because I think they're taking...
They'll revolutionize it.
They are.
Degree,
and they're making it a daytime operation. I mean, you know, you want to start the operation at 7 a.m. instead of 2 a.m? Sure, I'll take that.
Right.
They make everything better for the transplant programs, and therefore those people are going to be fresher to take care of their patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm all for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, many, many times I was able to relate that you were like walking the halls and checking on your patients in the middle of the night and you weren't home.
Yeah.
And it was lonely. But you were doing like such an amazing work that I have to tell you, I feel immensely honored to interview you and to know you.
That means a lot to me.
I think you're a great, great person.
Thanks for saying that. That does mean a lot to me. Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, commendable. And I hate to say this because I meet a lot of people. I mean, you're not like the average person in that, you know, there's so much authenticity and there's so much to you that it's my honor to do this interview with you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And thanks for the conversation.
Yeah. All right. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to this. It might be one of my favorite. And these are my kids too, these interviews, but I'm going to say it's like right up there with definitely the top few interviews. So honored to be here, and I hope you're blessed by this as well. Thank you, everybody. Have a good day. Bye.